Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Come to the Window, a novel, by Howard Norman. Narrated by Malcolm Hilgartner. Come to the window, sweet is the night air. Matthew Arnold. Whale intervenes on wedding night. Journal entry April 28, 1918, 3:30 a.m., Parsborough. Whale intervenes on wedding night. Murder. Universal stenotype machine. Pocket diaries. Urgent language. On his first posting as a court stenographer, Peter Lear immediately got it wrong, and I mean in the first 30 seconds. 3 days ago, I was dispatched by the evening mail from Halifax to Parsborough. In this small fishing outport set along the Bay of Fundy, I'm covering a preliminary hearing whose sole purpose is to determine if the facts warrant a full trial in the provincial court. It's all up to Byron Spencer, the presiding magistrate. Here is what I know so far. Elizabeth Frame is accused of murdering her husband, Everett Dewis. The incident took place on the night of April 22nd, roughly 11 hours after they had exchanged marriage vows at St. George's Anglican Church. I was allowed to see their room on the top floor of Ottawa House at Partridge Island, situated right at the mouth of Parsborough Harbour. That fateful night, the newlyweds' twin dormer windows overlooked a moonlit bay. It was a room traditionally reserved for visiting dignitaries, which had been few. Lucy Maud Montgomery slept there when, in the summer of 1908, she'd come to read from Anne of Green Gables at the Anglican Girls' School on Victoria Street. The room has a four-poster bed, also a botanical border quilt and otherwise white bedclothes. It has a clawfoot bathtub and a private bathroom. It has an armoire and bedside tables. In fact, I described the decor when I filed today's coverage with my editor, Albany Musgrave, who wired directly back saying she was giving me one column only, with the heading, Whale Intervenes on Wedding Night. I'm writing this by candlelight in room 103 of Gillespie House Inn, right in the village. The inn is temporarily closed to the public. Upstairs, in room 210, Elizabeth Frame herself is under what might be called house arrest. There's three men from Truro hired to sit in six-hour shifts outside her door. These stolid fellows, Mr. Astoria, Mr. Brewster, Mr. Sultan, alternately sleep in room 208, which has twin beds. Byron Spencer is on the third floor, in room 301, and his assistant, Bevel Cousins, is in 304. The stenographer, Peter Lear, is down the corridor from me, in 109. That's the nighttime configuration here in Gillespie House Inn. Today it was balmy for nearly May, as I overheard, and I'm told that there have been outlandish cloud skirmishes every morning for 2 weeks now. Yet there's been only slight rain. The Bay of Fundy has been relatively calm, and the nights have been clear. I cannot wait a moment longer to mention the unusual, most of all, phenomenon, which is a whale presently rotting on the beach, all but constantly attended by carrion gulls. In fact, it had washed up on Mr. and Mrs. Dewis's wedding night, not 100 meters from Ottawa House. I've been to see the whale. It's right there in front of the wooden pilings, either bloated or collapsed, depending on which precinct of its bulk and length, whether flukes, gullied throat pleats, dorsal ridge, or pale underside. A clothespin pinched my nostrils closed, but still one has to breathe. Lord have mercy, some dogs have had at the whale. Crows, too. Apportioned for foxes. But predominantly gulls. And that many gulls can be deafening. It is a gargantuan, sad corpse, and I found it difficult to imagine it swimming freely, a vessel of eternity, as Herman Melville put it, through the watery depths. Standing there, stunned at how puny the human species is, I thought of what my wife, Amelia Morley, said after she'd read Moby Dick. It seems that Mr. Melville has written the lost final chapter of the Old Testament. I miss my wife terribly. Schooled in London, She was the first ever woman to be resident surgeon at Victoria General Hospital. But for the past 6 months now, she's been in Arc and Etaples in France, working at the No. 7 Stationary Hospital out of Dalhousie University. In a letter she wrote, "Tovey, my love, I've seen things I never could imagine, let alone that I'd actually see. Influenza is everywhere, like an invisible demon. And here in Etaples, young men and older men are patients, ruins of their former physical selves. So many amputations, broken, fever-ridden, mustard gas coughs heard all night. We even have German sick and wounded. Men ask me to pray with them, though I feel as if I merely get through prayer rather than believe in it, even on their behalf. But every so often I'm convinced. I've even been asked to write to their families." The whale's eyes were filmed over. A local fisherman, Petrus Dollard, told me, "This past Sunday, the whale's stench broadcast up to St. John's Anglican Church, so that some parishioners departed mid-sermon. Rector Thomas Shrevard was none too happy about that." For a decade now, I've covered such hearings in every corner of the province. I keep one notebook for the odd thought, another notebook for interviews, and a third for little maps of whatever village. In the time allowed, you must try to notice, eavesdrop on, and learn everything possible. Albany likes to use the word sleuthing. From what I've learned, just from day one of the hearing, the whale might be seen as the start of Elizabeth Frame's mortal difficulties. What's more, I contend that the very sight of this whale summoned up dramatic aspects of Elizabeth's soul, mind, and spirit. Why do I suggest such a thing? Because in the witness chair, Elizabeth herself talked about her murderous act as if it were a biblical moment. For example, she said that she'd risen from the bed, naked as Eve, looked out the window, and thereby saw the spectacle of a Leviathan as if torn from the Book of Psalms. She then had studied the whale for a few moments, even said a prayer for it. And it was at this point, by her estimation, somewhere around 4 a.m., she had said, "Darling, come to the window. A whale has intervened on our wedding night." But Everett Dewis refused her request, and a certain rage of disappointment overtook her. So that when Everett fluffed the pillow in a deliberate way that had reminded Elizabeth of someone playing a few quick notes on the accordion, she demonstrated this, yawned, and then turned away from her. Elizabeth promptly went into his leather satchel, removed his military revolver, and said, "Everett, here comes a dry morsel," and shot him 3 times in the body. She then threw on Everett's nightshirt and went down to visit the whale. By the way, that thing Elizabeth said, "Everett, here comes a dry morsel." My room has a King James Bible, and I finally found the passage I was looking for in Proverbs chapter 17, verse 1. "Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife." A dry morsel. A bullet. However, as compelling as "darling, come to the window" was, they weren't the first words Elizabeth uttered in the witness chair, in the spacious dining room of Ottawa House Inn that had become a makeshift courtroom. And therefore they weren't the first words Peter Lear recorded. No, the instant she sat down, according to my pocket watch, 9:15 a.m., in the ladderback chair provided by Josephine Huntley, the proprietor of Ottawa House, Elizabeth Frame, unprompted, said, "The saddest part was, just a few hours before I killed my new husband, in our matrimonial bed there had been contrapuntal moans." I doubt that every Jewess would have found that the saddest part. Obviously, in saying what she'd said, Elizabeth had outright confessed to the murder, and now all that was left to hear was how, and maybe a little of why, it had come about. It was as if everyone in the makeshift courtroom had to abruptly detour their curiosities from one mystery to another. I actually jotted down contrapuntal in my notebook and followed it with a big question mark. In my line of work, I'm hardly a stranger to the English language, but I had no earthly idea what contrapuntal meant. Apparently neither did Magistrate Spencer. He was dressed in a well-traveled black suit, white shirt buttoned at the neck. A lanky fellow, about age 55, I would guess, with a kind of asymmetrical face, decidedly more vertical in structure than rounded, a luxurious head of thick black hair flecked white at the sideburns, very kind brown eyes, spectacles. Anyway, Spencer stopped the proceedings. He turned to his assistant and said, "Mr. Cousins, find me a dictionary." In about 15 minutes, Bevel Cousins had found a dictionary in the Anglican girls' school and delivered it to the magistrate. Spencer had remained seated behind his desk with his eyes closed. I thought he might be taking a brief nap, but more plausibly that was how he retreated inward.
"Thank you, Mr. Cousins," he said.
He then paged through the dictionary. By the way, I'm pretty sure that Byron Spencer, Bevel Cousins, Peter Lear, and myself, Tobias Havenshaw, are the only come-from-aways. I found it interesting how some 80 or more of Parlsboro's citizens, the population here stands at 357, all the chairs taken, and everyone else either sitting atop tables or standing along the walls, seemed united in rapt anticipation of a dictionary definition. I took this as a kind of sympathetic obligation to the accused and her family. You see, Elizabeth had been born and raised in Parsboro, so everyone knew her. Since age 9, she'd been half-orphaned. Ever since her father, Zachary Frame, was lost at sea, his empty grave has been in New Canaan Cemetery, whereas her mother, Elsbeth Frame, sat front row not 10 meters from the witness chair. Finally, Magistrate Spencer said,
"Don't take this down, Mr. Lear. I'll tell you when to resume recording. I understand you're the first male legal stenographer in the province."
"I believe that's true, Your Honor," Lear said.
"Well, well," Spencer said. "How fortunate for us to have you, Mr. Lear."
"Thank you," Lear said.
"And is that the latest model of universal stenotype machine?" Spencer said.
"Yes, Your Honor, it is," Lear said.
"And was it provided by the province?" Spencer said. "And does it come out of your salary?"
"Yes to both," Lear said.
"Well, it's a handsome machine," Spencer said. "It can spell any word in the dictionary to boot."
Apparently Magistrate Spencer had wanted to demonstrate his sense of irony.
"You may resume recording," Spencer said.
On his desk, Spencer placed his coffee mug so that it propped open the dictionary and read out loud the definition of contrapuntal.
"Harmonically interdependent in rhythm and melodic contour."
At which point some fellow in the audience called out,
"Elizabeth, that word's going to keep me up to all hours of the night."
Allow me here to be influenced by the fact that Ottawa House Inn is situated so near the Bay of Fundy. A veritable wave of laughter now rolled forth from the audience. Magistrate Spencer let the wave land, as it were, at his feet, before striking the gavel and demanding silence. He turned to Elizabeth.
"Do you have anything to say, Mrs. Jewess?"
"Kindly refer to me as Miss Frame," Elizabeth said. "And yes, I do have something to say."
"Miss Frame, I only ask that you be civil," Spencer said.
Elizabeth Frame is 24. She has auburn hair cut in a style, as I overheard Josephine Huntley say, not without admiration, out of a magazine. She has almost an unfair natural beauty, which she seems neither to play up nor to play down. She's slim as a Christmas candle, and is 5 feet 9 inches tall, which I learned from her family physician, Dr. S.S. Particulate, which strikes me as a name the Canadian National Steamship Company might give to a steamer that makes Atlantic crossings. I would call Elizabeth's pattern of speech noticeable. Many of her sentences resolve in a downward lilt, the weight of the world on her tongue, and therefore whatever she says seems to contain resignation. She may well be a person who every day must work herself up to melancholy.
"Ever since she was a child," Josephine Huntley told me, "Lizzie liked to use big words for things a small word would do." Benefit of the doubt might allow that this was less show-offy than a young girl already attempting to refine her intellect, and courageous enough to do so even in her elementary school classroom. Still, it's true, going by this morning's testimony, her adult speech can seem like a pastiche of antiquities. But maybe she always wanted language to single her out. I consider myself a student of people. I like to think about such things. With Elizabeth Frame, of course. This is all just first impressions on my part. All the same, I've found that some people exhibit their temperaments in an immediately memorable fashion. I feel that Elizabeth is one of those. For instance, I learned from Bevel Cousins that in a preliminary interview, when Magistrate Spencer asked if her childhood was happy or unhappy, Elizabeth had replied, "By this moody, tremulous ocean I have always lived intensely." And Elizabeth's own mother said, "Lizzie often got words and phrases from poetry, hymns, and eventually novels, but she used them in a surprising way." I also learned from Elizabeth that at age 11 Elizabeth had said to Rector Shrevard, "When I get older, I'm going to write stories, and you should know I listen closely to every word of your fine sermons, so I'm putting what you say in the bank, and I'll be able to withdraw it whenever I want." Her mother then added that throughout her childhood, Elizabeth was expert at neatly tucking a warning into a compliment, which I thought was nicely put. In the witness chair, Elizabeth chose to wear the dress she was married to Everett Jewess in, a Victorian-style cream-colored muslin two-piece with 10 buttons up front, wide embroidered lapels, a silk bow in back, and a floral pattern on the sleeves and at the collar. Wearing her wedding dress for a hearing about murdering her husband on their wedding night was one of the most off-slant exhibits of pathos I'd ever experienced in a courtroom. She had to have put a lot of thought into wearing that dress. Looking down at her hands clasped together as if she was praying, Elizabeth thought for a moment and finally said, "You see, Everett and I moaned in ways that I described as contrapuntal because I'd been taking mail-order music composition lessons and recently had a whole new vocabulary." Magistrate Spencer hit the desk with his gavel, which stopped more laughter before it had even begun. He grimaced warningly at the audience. "Does your music composition teacher have a name?" he said.
"Yes, his name is Oscar Asch," she said. "He lives in Halifax. He's Bavarian by birth, but he's applied to become a Canadian citizen."
"On principle, always a good idea," Spencer said.
Elizabeth hesitated a moment, then delivered a real wallop of a fact. "It was Oscar Asch who picked out and provided my wedding dress, which I'm presently wearing," she said. "All at his own expense. The dress was part of his own proposal of marriage to me. He's a widower, you see. What's more, Oscar had no knowledge of my previous engagement to Everett Jewess. I'm sure none of this reflects well on me. But the dress fits nicely, don't you think?" It took a moment, through the collective inward gasps and murmurs and one, "Oh, my," before Magistrate Spencer struck his gavel again. The room hushed right down. "I wrote in my notebook, 'She married Everett Jewess. She was in love with someone else? What is going on here?'" Elizabeth forged ahead. "Around 5 weeks or so before I married Everett, I made a visit to Halifax. I told my mother that it was to pick out my wedding dress. She wanted to accompany me in this endeavor, as any mother would, but I insisted that I wanted the adventure of the city on my own. I hadn't been there before, you see. And in Halifax I rendezvoused with Oscar Asch, a rendezvous that lasted 3 whole nights, with the days spent together in between."
"And how long had these mail-order lessons been taking place?" Spencer said.
5 months. In total, Oscar Asch and I have exchanged 8 letters, Elizabeth said. "That is perfectly equal at 4 each. You can pack a lot of hopes and dreams in a letter. Did you know that?"
"I'll want to examine Mr. Ash's letters," Magistrate Spencer said.
"I hereby give my mother permission to provide them," Elizabeth said. "By the way, my mother approved of the dress. Of course,
She thought I'd picked it out myself.
Peter Lear is age 27 and was born in Sydney Mines, Nova Scotia. I know for a fact that in 1916 he was inducted into the 25th Battalion, Nova Scotia Regiment, Canadian Expeditionary Force. He fought in France and was wounded in November 1917 at the Battle of Passchendaele in Belgium. He uses a cane to compensate his right side. He shipped home in January 1918 and passed his court stenographic exam in March. I noticed that Lear crouched forward at the universal stenotype, his face set with an almost comical determination. To me it looked a little painful. Benefit of the doubt dictates, no pun intended, that I take into consideration how new he is to the profession. Even his posture is apprenticing. All right, a young man wanting to be good at his job, to lean into it, should not be faulted for that. In his dark brown corduroy suit and trousers, too heavy for spring, Lear was formal, if threadbare. He also wore a white shirt and taupe necktie loose at the knot. He had noticeably scuffed shoes. Lear is just short, by American measure, of 6 feet in height, I'd guess. I could well imagine that even if receiving the much-needed attentions of a barber, his dark brown hair might retain a restless aspect. He has brown eyes. He might consciously dress to match his eyes, I couldn't possibly know. He has a downward smile. Overall, Lear is what Amelia might describe as handsome in a careless way, that is, unaffected. A rather interesting man to look at and take in, I feel. Some men and women continue to evidence their youthful physiognomy well into middle age. For example, when my wife Amelia smiles, she seems to be smiling out of a photograph of herself at age 12, or even old age. But I would have to predict the opposite will be true of Peter Lear. His exhausted expressions seem to forecast how his looks will eventually settle. I suppose that this is merely advance notice of the fate of the body. Amelia might say that Lear looks beyond his years.
"Mr. Lear, please scroll back the tape and read the testimony from the beginning," Magistrate Spencer said.
I must confess that at this point Peter Lear drew my utmost sympathy, and in fact I cringed on his behalf when shortly after he'd followed Magistrate Spencer's instruction. Lear cleared his throat and read, "The saddest part was, just before I killed my new husband, in our matrimonial bed there'd been contrapuntal moons." Whether Lear had mistakenly written contrapuntal moons, and therefore had read it correctly, or whether he'd simply mispronounced moans, I did not know. Either way, no amount of gavel-pounding could fend off the ensuing laughter. It just went on and on. Even Elizabeth Frame shook her head back and forth, incredulous. Peter Lear had, in equal measure, a look of despair and embarrassment. He tried to carry on with reading the transcript, but Spencer said,
"Mr. Lear, it's fine. Please, cease and desist. It's all right. It's fine."
The gavel took effect this time.
"Mr. Lear," Spencer said, "you do realize, don't you, that at night, when we gaze at the heavens, we are able to see only the one moon?"
"I do realize that," Lear said.
"I'm so relieved," Spencer said.
He flicked through the dictionary, stopped at a page, and read,
"Erratum, an error in speech or printing. Let's call it an erratum, then."
Speechless, Peter Lear stared into the middle distance. But the proceedings had gone off the rails, and Spencer did the correct thing by saying,
"Let's resume this hearing tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
Spencer left the dining room. He'd put in about 2 hours of work for the taxpayers of the province. As for Peter Lear, when he stood up from his chair, he knocked the stenograph machine off its stand, though managed to catch it, and thus spared himself more humiliation. It's a particularly fragile instrument, I'm told. Mevil Cousins escorted Elizabeth Frame from the room. She embraced her mother on the way. And then the rest of us filed out of Ottawa House. Coffee and a cheese sandwich for lunch in my room. Then I spent some of the afternoon talking to people.
I had particularly hoped to track down anyone who might have seen Elizabeth immediately after the gunshots. Often the kind of long articles I write for the crime pages of the Evening Mail become part of the forensics of communal memory. But today, I only found one eyewitness, Josephine Huntley. I'd heard she often burned the midnight oil, doing paperwork and whatnot in her office. I found her there on the first floor of Ottawa House. Josephine is approaching stout and is ambidextrous, which I imagine sounds no more than disparate elements, but were things I noticed and learned right off. When I walked into her office, she was pecking away one-fingered on a typewriter with her right hand while drinking a cup of tea with her left.
"Want to see me type with my left hand?" she said.
"No, thank you," I said.
"Because I'm known for typing with either hand," she said.
She looked relaxed in a kind of house dress, and her dark brown hair fairly cascaded to shoulder length, framing her pleasant face. Her voice was gravelly, but I didn't know whether that was its natural timbre, or if she was suffering a sore throat or worse. When she coughed a little, she said,
"Don't be alarmed. It's not Spanish flu. In fact, there's nothing Spanish in Parsboro. I've been to the doctor. It's not influenza. These days you get even the slightest headache, you worry until the doctor says elsewise."
I introduced myself and said, "I heard you're a night owl, and so I had thought you just possibly might have seen Elizabeth Frame after the gunshots." Stiffly cordial at first, she said she'd not resist talking about what she'd seen the night of the murder. "Not resist" had a touch of ambivalence about it, but I was a total stranger to her. What should have I expected?
"I'll provide some facts, but no personal emotions," she said. "How's that?"
"That would be fine."
"I'm a friend of the family, after all," she said. "Zachary Frame, for instance, Lizzie's father, is sacred to the memory, poor man."
"I understand."
"Well, whether you do or not, go on. Ask your question."
Right away I noticed a telescope in the corner of her cluttered room. "Do you like stargazing?"
"It's quite simple. Amateur astronomy is welcome on a sleepless night."
"Mrs. Huntley, were you by any chance stargazing on the night of the murder?"
"Of course I heard the gunshots. But before that, I'd been so busy looking at the Ursus Major constellation, I didn't even notice God's largest creature tumble onto the beach. Distracted by the heavens, you might say. It was only seeing Lizzie Frame walk right past my window on the porch here, wearing a nightshirt and looking preternatural. That's when I properly adjusted my telescope and followed her down the beach. She was holding the revolver in her right hand, though she's left-handed."
"What happened next?"
"What happened next, I will never forget. I just will never forget it."
"I'm all ears."
"Lizzie stood with her forehead pressed against the whale. Through the telescope, I saw her mouth moving, like she was talking to the creature. And then she climbed up along the tail, keeping her balance, keeping her balance, keeping her balance. She mainly, on all fours, got to the blowhole. And then she pressed the revolver right down into it. It was a once-in-a-lifetime sight, that's for sure. That exact thing just cannot have happened before, and won't again, because, Mr. Havenshaw, how could it? But God, as my witness, that is what happened."
Distraught to the point of tears, Josephine Huntley, without another word, stood up and showed me the door. I had dinner at 6 p.m. in the dining room of Ottawa House. There was one cook and one server, a young woman named Rebecca Stock, who was about 17 or so. Elizabeth Frame sat at a corner table with upright, square-shouldered Mr. Astoria and upright, square-shouldered Mr. Sultan. Still in her wedding dress, Elizabeth looked exhausted and crestfallen as a person could. It would suggest deep suffering, but I didn't know the secret contradictions of her heart, did I? I only knew what I'd heard at the hearing. I only knew she'd murdered her husband. I only knew she'd just reached over and taken up the remainder of Mr. Sultan's steak and potatoes with her fork, eaten it quickly, and still looked famished. It was at about 7:30, while sipping whiskey from a glass filched from the dining room, I'd sat propped against pillows in my room writing in this journal. But after half an hour, tempted to carry out the devil's errand, as Amelia might say, I carried the bottle down the corridor to Peter Lear's room. There I ran into Rebecca Stock, who was carrying her own bottle of whiskey.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?